Mr. Rosenblatt is, I think, probably considered certainly the dean of Orthodox Jewish journalism in the United States, and maybe a very small group to be dean of, I'm not sure. And you've already read some of the articles that are listed as from the tenure in the tenure as editor of the Jewish Week, specifically regarding the Warner case, and I think the very thoughtful meditation on the issues associated with being a journalist in the Jewish community and what one's responsibility is and to whom one's responsibility is. And I'm very grateful that you agreed to come and looking forward very much to your presentation.
Thanks very much. I probably will repeat some of the things that you've actually read, some of the pieces we sent, but I guess I just would start with some of the tensions and some of the problems that one has, I think, in Jewish journalism, besides even the halakhic issues about Lashon Hara, and I think we can get into a little bit later, but you know, how should a journalist, is a Jewish journalist any different than any other journalist? So let me give you an actual case that we had to deal with. It's a very dramatic case, but there are variations of the kinds of decisions that come our way all the time. This was a few years ago. There was a student at NYU, a Jewish girl, who apparently committed suicide, fell from a dorm window on a high floor, and was in the fall of the year. I don't know exactly when it was. It was in the last 5-6 years. And it happened on a Sunday, and it was a big story in the media in New York. First of all, although it was early in the semester, there'd been a couple of suicides already. And her picture's on the front page of, you know, the tabloids, it's on TV, it's on radio, it's in the New York Times. And we generally have an editorial meeting on Monday. The paper comes out once a week. We go to press. Now we go to press Tuesday nights, but then we go to press on Wednesday morning. So at, just before the editorial meeting on Monday, I got a call from a rabbi in the community who said he's very close with the family. Obviously, the family has been, you know, in shock and in grief, and that they specifically asked that there be no story about this in the Jewish Week. I don't know, he would go into great detail about why. I assume because, you know, this was like very close to the community where they were involved with. And he said, you know, I'm making this request of you. So we talked about it at the editorial meeting in terms of, you know, what we should do. And so before I, you know, tell you how it worked out or didn't work out, I just would pose a question to you guys as I deputize you as a member of the editorial staff of Jewish Week. What would you suggest and, you know, and why? Should you run the story? Should you not run the story? How do you do the story if you do it? Or if you don't do it, why not? Yeah.
I love the Jewish Week about this, but I know that in other Jewish newspapers, you know, a bet instead of reporting on the story, they'd be so more.
Okay, like an obituary or truth in its type article, okay? Yeah.
I'm just wondering if there's a difference that the Jewish people, you know, weekly, it's not a different responsibility than, you know, the getting the table, which is, you have to report more stories, and, you know, how we think we sort of have more of a, you know, now, just kind of do it more, you know, and you know, the information about elsewhere and how to, you know, so in that sense, it might be different.
Right.
But, where it doesn't come new, you know, you get as much information reported as it's not, you know, so much of a published long-term issue.
Okay. I mean, that's all changing now, actually, with websites and updating, you know, even weekly update things all the time. But, okay, here we go. Yeah. Okay. That should be a factor. I mean, it's a good question. So, another, okay, well, let's see what other comments are. Yes.
Is it possible that as a policy, it's not in the Jewish Week that I'm just starting personal requests about which
there is going on? To stop people from calling. But no, okay, sure. But so,
So it's a more general question, what is the goal of the Jewish Week?
Uh-huh.
Is this in line with that or in conflict with that? I think that's going to also determine.
Right. Yeah, you cut right to the chase, right? So the question is exactly, well, what's the Jewish newspaper? Well, you know, if it was just like any other newspaper, they all covered the story. Well, we should cover the story too. If it's some kind of paper of record of the Jewish community, you know. On the other hand, you want to have a certain sense of responsibility and empathy for your community. Right? Somebody calls you in pain and says, please don't do the story. Do you do the story or not? As I said, this is like a dramatic case. But in some ways, every week, you're dealing with some certain tensions about what's your responsibility to the community, what should people know, what shouldn't they know? Yeah.
The question is, Rebecca, why isn't there any consistent coming in third place in general, other than the fact that the newspapers picked it up? And we know lots of suicides in the Jewish community.
They used to say that a Jewish news story was, you know, there was an earthquake in some faraway place. I mean, you probably still see headlines like this, you know, 3,000 people, including two Jews, died, you know, in an earthquake. I mean, is that a Jewish story? So the fact that she was very much involved, apparently, in Jewish life at school was in some of the stories in the other papers. but those are the kind of questions we ask ourselves too. You know, people are obsessed, of course, with entertainers, celebrities. You know, they're Jewish. Does that make an interesting story for us? Michael Jackson has two Jewish kids, at least, right? He's two biological Jewish kids. Is that a story? I don't know. Let's see if I get through the rest of this without talking about Michael Jackson. Give you a break. So part of our ongoing dilemma, I guess, in determining what our identity is, or what you were suggesting, or whatever our goals, is sort of the first commandment in journalism is to expose, to shed light on things that are in the shadows, to let people know what's going on. And people pick up the newspaper in the morning or, you know, look online or whatever. There's a certain expectation you have about finding out what's going on in the world. So that's sort of evidence to people. But for the organized Jewish community, when it comes to that community, which is often very protective of, the obligation seems to be more about pretty much the opposite. It's to close ranks, you know, to present a positive image to the rest of the community. We worry about how we look. Shunt up to the good. You know, we worry about how other people are going to look about what happens in our community.
What's the thing that the Jewish leadership is not Jewish?
It's not Jewish?
Yes.
it's really hard to say. Certainly now, I mean, particularly with in the age of the internet and stories being sent all around, it's even more difficult to tell in terms of readership. I suspect that, you know, the great majority of our circulation is in the Jewish community, but a lot of, you know, government agencies, other media, you know, readers often will do a story and it gets picked up by some bigger newspapers. So whether it's a lot of individual subscribers or not, I'm not sure, but, it, you know, sort of gets out there. You know, I just briefly, biographically, I went to YU. I was on the staff of the Commentator all 4 years. That's really where I got really interested in journalism. I had no guidance counselor. I don't know how things have changed, but it never occurred to me that I could have a career in journalism because it was a problem of keeping Shabbos. And so I started out in going to graduate school in English. I thought I'd be a professor. And while I was in graduate school, I ended up getting a part-time job for the London Jewish Chronicle New York office. And I didn't have this incredible epiphany, but gradually over a few months, I started realizing that I liked this better than I liked that. And so I went into journalism. I worked for TV Guide for 2 years as a sports editor. Cured me of mass circulation. At the time, TV Guide now was sold last year for $1. Not the individual copy, the whole publication was sold for $1. That was instead. But in its heydays in the 70s, circulation was like 25 million a week. It was very, very successful. Until cable TV came in and took out the need for TV listings. But anyway, so then I worked for, actually I worked for the Jewish Week for 2 years after that. It was a very small newspaper. It was privately owned, had a small circulation, and I was younger by probably 35, 40 years of the next youngest editor. They'd covered World War II, and I learned a lot from these people. It was a great job for me because any job that involved physically leaving the office, you know, I got to do. They worked the phones. But the paper was having financial problems. I heard about a job in Baltimore, and I took that. I was editor of the Baltimore Jewish Times, which was a privately owned, financially successful Jewish paper. I was there for 19 years. And came quote back to the Jewish Week, although there was nobody there who knew that I'd ever worked there before, 16 years ago. So that's my biography. But whether it was paper in Baltimore, which was a pretty tight-knit Jewish community of about 100,000 people, they all live in three zip codes, or the Jewish Week in New York, which is, it's hard to think of New York as a community. It's like many, many, many communities, all seemingly at war with each other at times. The same kinds of issues come up all the time. There were different pressures, either from Jewish organizations. Most prominent would be the Federation in that community, which represents a lot of financial and communal clout about stories that they would prefer you not do, stories that they prefer you would do, how you would do them. Stories about Israel, you know, whether you ever criticize any policy of the state of Israel. These kinds of issues come up all the time. Just to tell you what happened in this suicide case, we did have a reporter looking to make some calls, talk to some people. We had essentially a day to see if we had a story. Lots of times we will assign things to reporters and sort of see if they pan out, if it turns into a story or not, if we have something to say. That's
different or significant. Essentially, Jewish newspapers, like a lot of ethnic or any kind of specialty newspapers or magazines, are really aimed at a certain niche. We don't expect that people only read the Jewish Week from week to week and don't read, you know, the daily paper, or they don't look at the Jerusalem Post or other news about Israel. So it's really about finding areas that you think you have expertise, whether it's analysis about things that are going on or about covering the community in more depth than others do. So at the end of the day, I asked the reporter what she came up with, and she basically said she didn't have anything that wasn't in the other papers already. And what we decided to do is do a more at length story about suicides in the community among young people, because there have been a number of them and several sort of prominent cases. And that story probably didn't run for another couple of months. And when it didn't run, it made mention without names that, you know, that there had been this case at NYU. So, again, I don't mention that as saying that this was the ideal way to cover the story, but just in practical terms, A, that's what happened, and B, I think it does, you know, sort of crystallize some of the issues that you deal with about what should be in a Jewish newspaper or what shouldn't. And there was a story in Baltimore when I was there. It was a very prominent Jewish leader in the community who was on trial for financial fraud. And I got a call from somebody in the some Jewish leader, and he said, "Did you see the Baltimore Sun today on the front page?" It's the daily paper, and he said, "It's outrageous that they mentioned that this guy's Jewish. What does his religion have to do with anything?" I said, "I read the story. I don't remember seeing that." And he said, "Yeah, it said so-and-so, a Pikesville developer." Pikesville was a very Jewish neighborhood in Baltimore, but, I mean, people's perception was such that, you know, if you said it's in Pikesville, it sounded, you know, that's how people read it, as if it was an indictment of the Jewish community. Not that unlike the first day or two stories about Bernie Madoff in the New York Times. The first couple of stories back in December, look, I think there were like three or four references to the fact that he was Jewish, because David Harris, who's the head of the American Jewish Committee, had a letter to the editor that was published a couple of days later that basically said, you know, that's enough already. Why do you have to, like, hit us over the head with the fact that this guy is Jewish? So there's certain sensitivities that we have in the community, even about how we read any story. And that's true of readers everywhere, but I think it's heightened, particularly in the Jewish community, and particularly when it's a sensitive story or critical story or, you know, a delicate story, and how we are perceived by other people, not to mention how, you know, we think about ourselves. So I wanted to spend a little time on the Lanner story and sort of give you this, in some ways, how it, you know, how it came about and some of the things that I think I've learned from it and other things that still mystify me. But actually the story came out just about 9 years ago, in June 2000, and it had begun about 7 or 8 months before that. Actually, we had a Shabbos guest who turns out had been a victim of Lanner, and I really didn't know, you know, this whole business, although I soon learned that lots of people knew lots of things or heard lots of things about him for many years. So he said, you know, I should look into it, and he would give me some names of people that I could talk to. So I found out very early on, starting with this particular person, that people were very reluctant to let me use their name in the story, understandably. Some of these people had been victimized 20 years before, even longer, and were still in many ways traumatized by it. And as I learned, a lot of these people had never talked about it even to their closest relatives, to their spouses. So one person I spoke to early on said, you know, I'm not comfortable. I know it's important for the credibility of the story to have real names, but I'm not comfortable with it. Maybe if you got a few other names and let me know, then I would lend my name as well. And I said, you know, that makes sense. And he said, if you get about 40, 50 people, this is serious, if you get about 40, 50 people, then I'll be comfortable with it too. That's when I began to learn sort of the scope. And I think over a period of about 6 or 7 months, I interviewed at least 40 people who said they'd been abused in either physically, emotionally, or both, mostly women, but a number of men as well. And over a really long period of time, it went back 30 years. And gradually, in talking to a lot of them, and they're really like the heroes of this whole story because, first of all, they opened up and they talked about it. And second of all, most of them, when I explained to them that this story, because of it was a, it was such an important story, I think, to get out into the community, that if they were going to have to, I had to have real names in it, or it wasn't going to have the same impact. And many of them, you know, agreed to do that, which was really heroic. I also started talking to officials of NCSY and of OU, many who had, you know, had known or worked with Lanner for many years. And one was his boss, who essentially confirmed that there had been a problem, like literally 30 years ago. And he said, and I warned him then, I think it's in the story, I warned him then that if I ever heard any allegation again, even if it didn't bear out, you know, that his career was over. So I said, well, what happened the next time? You know, and he just didn't say anything. So so this was a pattern, and a lot of people in NCSY, whether kids in NCSY, parents, sort of knew that that this was a problem. There were whole regions of NCSY that didn't allow Rabbi Lanner to speak in their region, but somehow it went on. I got to the point where I not only did I feel like I had enough material, one of the amazing patterns of all this is the people I spoke with, even who were people who had been abused, you know, some 25 years ago and some, you know, 8 years ago, essentially told me the same story. It was over and over. They used the same words, the same language, the same patterns. And many of them thought they were the only ones that had to, you know, had these encounters and didn't know about it. Others knew that there were others, but it was very consistent what I was hearing. And I realized that they kept telling me about more and more people I could talk to. So we're talking about hundreds of people. But I felt like I was hearing the same thing over and over again. It was time to put this together as a story. And so I had written most of the story, and I was becoming more aware of just the consequences of, you know, publishing it. And that's when I called a rabbi who, ironically, I didn't really know, but I'd been on a panel with him a year before. It was a panel sponsored by the OU. That was the irony. And he was the expert discussing Jewish journalism, journalism and Jewish law, and the one or two other editors of Jewish newspapers were on the panel. I was very impressed with him. And so I called him up one night, and I said, I've got a story that I'm struggling with about, you know, publishing, and I wanted to give a little guidance about this whole issue of Lashon Hara. Just to mention, when I was in Baltimore, and we used to invite different people from the community sometimes to come and speak to our staff, we once asked an Orthodox rabbi to come in, and he chose to talk about Lashon Hara, and he brought a couple of passages from Chafetz Chaim, and he read them and translated them, you know, basically saying you can't talk anything bad about anybody, can't say anything nice about anybody because somebody else's system. And he closed the sefer and said, well, that's pretty much what I wanted to say. And it was like I looked around the room and saw the reporters, you know, and one of them said finally, well, how does this apply to us? And he said, I just, you know, that's it. I read it to you, and it was pretty much the end of the discussion. He left a few minutes later. We had a very interesting, long discussion about it afterwards. But anyway, so I called this rabbi, and I said, I can tell you as much or as little as you want to know about the case. And he said, tell me as little as possible. So I never mentioned any names or name of the organization. I just said, there's a rabbi who deals, you know, he's in charge of dealing with kids, and he's been alleged to have abused, you know, many, many teenagers for over a long period of time. And he said, well, look, the criteria is you should do whatever is possible to prevent further abuse of kids. He said, if there's any way you can do that without publishing the story, then that's what you should do. If you come to the conclusion that that the only way you're going to be able to prevent kids from being abused is to publicize it, then you're not only permitted to do it, but you're obligated to do it. He said, but, you know, you have to make the determination. And so I thanked him, and I did come to the pretty clear conclusion that the only way this was ever going to stop is if this story saw the light of day, and subsequent events only underscored that for me. So we did publish the story. I naively told my wife the day the story came out, I said, well, I'm finished with that story. You know, it was like the last 8 months. And in a sense, that's one of the biggest surprises. Well, there are a couple things. One is that the reaction in the community was like right down the middle. It seemed like a lot of people were totally shocked and outraged and thought this was terrible. And a lot of other people said, oh, we've known about this for years. Everybody knows about, you know, Rabbi Lanner, which was very upsetting, but I guess not that surprising in terms of other similar kinds of scandals. But the other surprise to me was the tremendous amount of calls I started getting saying, well, you wrote about this rabbi who was abusive. What about this guy? And what about this guy and this yeshiva and this community? And I would say 95% of the were Orthodox rabbis, many of them teachers working with kids. And I wrote a column, I think I sent you like 2 weeks later, saying this is like not the job of the newspaper. We need some kind of mechanism in the Jewish community to deal with this. Because what I was finding was that people had gone to their rabbis, they'd gone in some cases to the best in terms of some divorce cases. They had tried the usual routes that the community had set up, and they were very frustrated and felt that nobody was listening to them, nothing was happening. So the newspaper was kind of the last stop. And unfortunately, that part of it hasn't really changed that much. I think we did get, we got like 1,000 letters, emails, calls, things like that. Most of the response was very favorable from AMCA. But I have to say that a number of some prominent and other rabbis in the community were spoke out against me, against the story, that it was Lashon Hara, that it was terrible to say these things about a prominent colleague. And a couple of them called for my resignation, a couple of rabbis, you know, trying to get me fired through the board of the Jewish League, which was very supportive, by the way. And so in that sense, in that narrow sense, anyway, compared to like the Catholic priest scandal, I'm not comparing it in terms of quantity or the scope, but in terms of how the other clergy responded to these criticisms, there are a lot of parallels, very disturbing parallels about sort of closing ranks, supporting your colleague and protecting your colleague instead of protecting kids. And I think that's still true. I think since then, a lot of positive things have happened, certainly within the OU and within NCSY, in terms of establishing higher standards, more parental involvement, just certainly an awareness about these issues really were not talked about at all, even, 10 or 15 years ago. And so I think that's been very positive, but there's still not really a mechanism to deal with it. There's Mark Trach, who's a rabbi, who's a pulpit rabbi, started an organization called J-Safe, which specifically is to deal with these kinds of issues. He's done a lot of research and has a lot of material about how things should be done, but I think his goal was to be sort of like the good housekeeping seal of approval for Jewish institutions like schools and camps, and I think in practice I don't think that's happening. And I think in a lot of cases now that still come up, what happens if a teacher in a school is alleged to have abused kids, generally what happens is that the person is quietly let go. They make some kind of arrangement with him. It's usually a him. And they go on to another community. And, 9 times out of 10, if not higher, they have a problem in the next community. So I really think it's an obligation for the Jewish community to not close its eyes to that and just say we took care of it in our Dalaramas and just... let the next community worry about it, but that's still what happens a lot of the times. Maybe I should take a pause here and open up for other things to talk about, but maybe let's take some questions or comments. Yeah.
One question I had, it seems that whenever you start to ask these sorts of policy questions, that only comes as as you said, at a very late point of the story, the majority of the New York Times has been involved and obviously have a lot invested in the story already. Are there ever stories that in the beginning of the story you already had that sort of philosophical question and you might come to a situation where you might not consider pursuing the story because of the whole question?
No, I mean, in practical terms, A, that hasn't happened, and I guess the larger question you can ask is, do we go to a halakhic source on a regular basis to deal with stories, that sort of outline that we deal with certain pressures and sensitive stories all the time. And the truth is we don't. Now, I like to think that although the reputation of journalism as it's practiced in this country is not always like the highest ethical levels, and there's a scandal now in England. I don't know if you're following finding that the like all levels of the media were hacking into the phone, cell phones of prominent politicians and government leaders, and it was like incredibly widespread practice. So I don't subscribe to that idea that, you know, journalists are, you know, just lowlife, and, you know, I know you're not saying that, but I'm saying I think that in a great majority of times, the same value system would apply about whether a story is a story or not, but, you know, at least for us, in terms of, you know, whether it should be pursued or not. Because I think even in, you know, other examples about Lashon Hara, a lot of times the loophole or the permission is when it comes to the greater community, the good of the community. So I think it's a tough call sometimes, and there will always be, you know, these gray areas. There was a case a few years ago, I was talking earlier on my ride from the train. Lilith Magazine, the Jewish Women's Magazine, Feminist Magazine, did a story about Shlomo Carlbach a few years after he died, where they spoke to a lot of young women who said that he had, you know, abused them physically. And part of the reason the story came out then is that Carlbach, after his death, was becoming, you know, described on such a high level that a lot of people who felt victimized by him wanted to speak out. And so if you take, I mean, that's an interesting halakhic issue, I think, is if the interpretation is taken, you know, sort of literally or narrowly about the criteria when you can publish or not, is if you're protecting somebody from, if you're protecting kids from future abuse, you might say if the person's not alive anymore, they're not going to do anybody any harm. Other people have interpreted, I guess, more liberally, saying, well, it, you know, just getting the story out there, making people more aware will prevent, you know, future abuse. So, I mean, to me, that's one of those gray areas.
I'm just wondering, when you're in one of these gray areas and you've already invested 6 months on a story, doesn't that in some way cause your judgment?
Well, I guess the, you know, maybe the tougher question to ask, which I ask myself, is what if he said, you know, halakhically, you really shouldn't do the story, you know. So I, you know, I don't know what I, honestly, I'm not sure what I would have done. It would have troubled me to think that there was, even though it seemed like clearly these people were being abused, and this guy who, you know, ended up, I guess you know the story, but after the story came out a couple of weeks later, two different young women who had been victimized by him within the last, I forgot what the law is in New Jersey because it changed, but they were still, you know, they could still press charges against him. They didn't know about each other, but they also had almost incredibly similar experiences. They came forward, he was arrested and brought to trial and sentenced and served several years in jail. It was about 4.5 years in jail. So I would think that somebody like that should be, you know, should face charges for it. But I haven't had to knowingly, you know, throw a halakhic interpretation to the wind and say I'm going to do the story anyway. I think they're all ad hoc. That's the thing. There's so many different variations of what's the story, and there's plenty of stories that we end up not doing because either we don't think we have anything new to say, we don't think we have enough information, we're basing too much of it on anonymous sources. You know, there are any number of reasons not to do some of these stories. Yeah.
Were there any details about the story you studied? In class, no, you studied the article. But were there any details you decided to recall in the article, you know, either because of, you know, whatever relevant sources or more copies of the
rock? It was a good time to take a pause. Yeah.
So you said the leader in Baltimore someone came in, spoke, and read from the time.
Yeah.
It prompted an interesting conversation. The rabbi himself, there wasn't really much to say to him, but like within the newsroom, that prompted an interesting conversation. So I'm curious what like some of the other employees' reactions were and what that conversation was about.
Well, part of it was there was just sort of, you know, after he left, it was like that's all he had to say. That, you know, we're looking for practical guidance. You know, it was like half kiddingly. Somebody said, "But at the time, had been the publisher of a newspaper. You know, it might have had the weather report in it, but that's probably about it." So part of it was sort of trying to explain what he was doing. But then it was, you know, these kind of issues. What are the parameters? What's off limits, and should anything be off limits? And not just about issues about Lashon Hara, let's say, but you know, what about writing about the state of Israel and sensitive stories there about security, or just in terms of the image. The stories come up that the genealogies are embarrassing to Israel, and you might know that they're absolutely true. I mean, the Israeli press is a pretty aggressive press, and there are very few stories that don't come out. But I like to think a lot depends not on whether you do the story, but how you do the story. So, you know, there should be a certain element of, extra empathy or sensitivity to a story, even if it's a very tough story.
I mean, do you think he was trying to tell you to shut down the newspaper? That's what I'm trying to get my head around.
I think he was so far, honestly, I think he was so far removed from some of the, like, practical issues that we dealt with as journalists that this was, I don't think he was trying to be cynical or anything. I think he was just saying, look, it's pretty black and white.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In your like, editorial meeting, do you have a method, or do you evaluate all the stories on the basis of the relevance or like feasibility of the story? And if so, how often do you either turn down a story or have to modify it because you decide that halachically the way it is now doesn't work?
So I'd say that in practical terms, it might come out on the same side, but I don't think our approach is saying, let's take a halachic look at the story. I think it's more, let's look at it journalistically. Is this a fair, is this a fair story to do? So as I said, I think I'd like to think that, the results are the same, but that's not the standard that we generally apply. And in this latter case, because of all that was all the baggage of it, that's where I did make the call. But you could certainly say, we should do that every week. We should do it with every story, but we don't. Yeah.
So, once again, you decide whether it's one of the story with your own ethical. Is there any way that you kind of wish? Was there any use? Is there any room for a greater life? Code
of
writing, however,
the
journalistic ethic. Is there any need for that?
That's a good question. I don't know if I call it, halachic code, but I think there should be more discussion in the community, or certainly in the Orthodox community or the modern Orthodox community. We did a story a couple of weeks ago about a prominent proseke who was heard to say that you can cheat on the taxes, basically. And he said, did we send you that one?
Didn't send
that one. No, okay. So I give you this. This happened a couple of years ago. We spoke in a show in Bergenfield, New Jersey. There were at least 100 people there. It was on Shabbos. And it was in a Q&A. And I think it was a loaded question, because I think the person who asked the question knew that this rabbi had a reputation of saying this. But he basically said, do you have to be fair, when you do your taxes? And he apparently gave like a 10-minute response that blew a lot of people away, that said that, you know, that Esau hated Yaakov and nothing's changed, that all Goyim, you know, still hate Jews, and you know, I wasn't there, but, you know, the gist of it certainly was that you don't have to be square when you do your taxes, and apparently he said a lot of other things that you wouldn't say on Brotherhood Week, you know, in public. What made the story interesting is that some people who were there were very upset at what was said. They asked the rabbi of the congregation to, you know, sort of make some corrective remarks, and apparently the next Friday night he said, you know, to speak, just to clarify, the speaker that we had last week believes that everybody should be ethical and honest. I believe that you should be, and the speaker believes that as well. So there were at least a few people who pursued it, and it turned out that the RCA, you know, the Rabbinical Council of Americans of OU, had a Baha Koski, and it includes not just members of the RCA, but other people as well, and this rabbi was on there. Bottom post view, and after this sort of percolated for a long time, and there were letters, people who were there wrote letters to the RCA and just said, this is what the guy said. I just, because the people who said that he made these allegations, the word got out that they made it up. So some people took umbrage at that, and they wrote these letters. Anyway, the Vaha posting suddenly disappeared off the website of the RCA. They just did away with it. And we were told by officials of the RCA that off the record, that the reason they did it, they didn't want to just embarrass him and take his name out, so they just did away with the whole thing, but that's why they did it. So we did a story about it, and of course we got killed for... why would you do a story about a prominent postdoc and you're just trying to embarrass him, and why would you do it 2 years after this alleged incident took place? Even though the story made it pretty clear, we thought, that because 3 days ago he was on the Vada postium, and 2 days ago there was no Vada postium, and that's why they did it. There are other stories we've done about... I mean, again, part of the fallout of the Flanner story was about the Beis Din that dealt with Rabbi Lanner in 1989, led by Rabbi Willig, that cleared him of everything. And only years later did some of the victims who were testified at this Beis Din come forward, and there was a lot of pressure for him and for the other people in the business to make some kind of public statement about it. And, you know, I wrote a few stories about it at the time. Rabbi Willard eventually did make a very powerful public statement saying that they were wrong, they didn't realize the depth of the problem, and made a full apology. But it came about under a tremendous amount of pressure on him of things that would have come out had he not. So,
just to say, what you're saying is, if anything correctly, a greater discussion about the halakha of journalism would be helpful in the Orthodox Jewish community. Not so much because it's some kind of wild west situation on journalism, but because the community doesn't fully appreciate
it. Yeah, I think that's true. You put it a little more succinctly than I did, but yeah. And just to open the discussion at all, I think is a scary thing for a lot of people, but that I think it's necessary, particularly, you know, in the 21st century, and how news is spread, how plugged in people are into you know, the rest of the world. They're not in some little shtetl, isolated from the rest of what's going on. Yeah.
And you see his value, a journalist, I was operating above the law, what kind of, if somebody's there on mission or value, you know, whether it's, you know, value beyond just conveying the news that, you know, all that value in itself, or it'd be in some ways, you know, beyond a lot of things, you know, kind of actually a little power wins, you know, is there a value to that?
Well, I mean, anybody can sue us any day of the week. And even if it's kind of a frivolous suit, it can cost, it can put newspapers out of business, you know. Very wealthy people can do that. And so we're certainly not above the law. And there are libel laws, you know, in this country. So... No, I don't think we think of ourselves as either above the law or sort of on a higher ethical, moral plane, you know, than others. But I think we, I think there are elements of our community that have kind of refused to deal with real issues. I mean, abuse is, you know, one dramatic issue. But even, you know, about what's legitimate criticism, let's say, of a prominent rabbi. There are people who just say that you can't, you know, this was an excuse in the income tax story. One of the rabbis told his congregant who was upset about what he'd seen, the rabbi told him basically it's okay to lie to protect Kavod HaRav. So, I mean, those are the kinds of issues I think that we, you know, we just don't talk about. Yes?
Is there a danger down to different reputations just for the active investigation when you don't yet know something's true? And how does that work into your decision about responding?
I'm sorry, about damaging their reputation?
Yeah,
just by... Well, I'm saying investigating. We just mean call people up.
You ask questions, what have you heard about such and such, and now the rumor that such and such happened is already there. And so does that affect how you choose which stories?
Well, I mean, again, I think it's all sort of how you approach it or how you do it. So I don't think we call up and, you know, and say, we heard that, you know, Joe Schmo is beating his wife. What do you think? So... You know, again, I don't know the specifics, but I mean, I know what you're saying, and you have to be very careful about, particularly in a story where you're just kind of fishing, you know. Often people will call up and say, you should look into this and this and that. They don't use my name, or they don't tell me their name, and just say, you know, this institution, you know, they're stealing people's money, you know. And so I don't think we just would... Start calling people and say we heard this institution or a bunch of them, you know. So it's like anything else. You try and have a thread and, you know, find people who will talk to you. But there, as I said, there are lots of stories that we don't do that we spend a lot of time on because either it's not true, whatever it was, you find out, or you don't think it's a legitimate story, or you just don't feel comfortable in your Kishka level, that, you know, and the higher the stakes, you know, the more sensitive you should be, that you just don't have enough information or enough solid, credible sources to you know, damage somebody's reputation. There was a guy, who was the Attorney General under Nixon, I think, or it was Meese, maybe, Ed Meese, I know he's... Hmm? Reagan, maybe it was him. That was some famous guy who was put on trial for some alleged misdoings when he was in office. And he was cleared. I mean, it was huge headlines. And then, you know, a year later came the trial, and he was cleared, and he had a press conference. And he said, you know, who do I go to get my reputation back? Is that who it was? Okay. Probably more than one guy who said that. But, you know, but that's a very... powerful statement, you know, because sometimes the press, you know, chews you up and spits you out and they're finished with you, but, you know, you got the rest of your life to live, and somebody will Google you now for the rest of your life, and that'll be the first thing that comes up, that you were tried for some crime, and it may or may not mention that you were found innocent, so those are things you have to take seriously, yeah.
And how do you ensure that you don't you're not trying them through the media. In many of these cases, do you go in with the assumption that if he's clear of a print an equally big story for, in many weeks to possibly take, or not, or you think it's the media's job to just,
ruin people's lives.
I'm saying, there are times that things are, one of the things that was coming out. Some of the, some people were saying that they were very early to the story, just wait until it goes to trial, and if it turns out it's true, then we'll deal with it, but let's wait until it was investigated. And it was, it turned out that they were guilty, but people, in the beginning, was picky, 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 and not to the court.
So, again, that's a concern. First of all, we have a lawyer, and any of these kinds of sensitive stories that I've been describing, we have, a lawyer look through it very carefully. Part of it is they'll ask, questions that we might not have thought about, and essentially it's to protect ourselves, so we're not libeling somebody, that we're being as fair as possible. But that's even with a story that's going to be very critical about an institution or a person. So that's part of it. And if we have screwed up, one of the legitimate concerns about the press is, even the New York Times, you see, on page two, they have a corrections page. Well, they say it's page two, which is right after page one. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't often have the same clout in making a correction as the big splashy headline on the front page that was the negative story. So, I can think of one or two times that were not as dramatic as the kind of cases I'm talking about, but where we run a story in the same space that the original story appeared. That's saying we got the story wrong. One thing Obama, whether people like Obama or not, I think he's tapped into, and part of it is the whole economic meltdown, but there's going to be a lot more transparency, or calls for transparency, across society. So when it comes to our community, I think it's going to be in terms of, day school tuitions and the whole issue now about Jewish day schools and whether they can survive, and tuition of $32,000 sustainable. People want to know, and I think I see this happening at some schools now, where they want to know what the school's budget looks like and where the money goes and what kind of policies. So that's that's not about allegations that people are stealing money, but they want to know more details. We're going to see a lot more of that, and not just in financial area. Yeah.
You just mentioned that if you got the story wrong, that you should explain that was wrong. I'm just wondering if you had any, if you published articles that you kind of in retrospect regret, and what kind of articles that you think.
Yeah, that's a good question. The truth is, most of the regrets I have are stories that we didn't do, that we should have done. One I can think of in Baltimore was this very prominent Jewish guy who owned a bank, savings and loan. This was in the 80s, and he was suddenly giving. He just suddenly became a big Bob Sadaka on a big grand level, and we heard allegations of all kinds of financial improprieties at the bank, and we interviewed him and. And we ran a story that was pretty toughy. It was kind of a positive story based on what he told us, and it might have had a paragraph of, some critics, but our instinct was that there was something fishy about this guy, and we should have waited and investigated more. But about 2 weeks later, I guess it was the Baltimore Sun, did it. Big investigation. It was a huge savings and loan scandal around the state. And again, it was a very embarrassing story to the Jewish community. yeah. It just so happened the guy and his wife were obese, and there were stories about how they would go into a restaurant and order everything on the menu and every dessert. So they became like the symbol of greed and gluttony, a big Jewish name. But I mean, those are kind of stories. It's not so much that we did a story that we found out later was wrong. It's that there are more stories we should have investigated and brought those kinds of investigations to light. And the truth is, again, practically, with there's some people who think of us, it's no secret, you know, that they criticize us for Orthodox fashion, because we've done a number of stories about sex abusers who happen to be Orthodox rabbis. So sometimes we weigh that and say, you know, should we do the pervert of the week and have a special section in the paper? Or is that going to help our reputation? But, you know, does it mean you shouldn't do these stories? And it's tough. Are you scratching or are you... Yeah.
How is the newspaper now, if someone who's been involved for a long time, how is it affected by the start of the internet? I mean, I can imagine certain differences immediately, but I'm interested to hear your perspective as somebody who went through the timeline.
Yeah. Well, certainly researching stories has become so much easier. I don't know, does anybody go to the library anymore? I don't want to date myself too much, but, you know, high school, you went to the library. It'd be nice if that's the only way you found stuff out. Now you can Google anything. I guess one thing that comes to mind that's troubling to me is the whole blogging world, particularly anonymous bloggers, who can say anything about anybody, who destroy people's reputations, which will be preserved forever on the internet by, you know, if they get enough hits and they move up the Google chart, and are very quick to condemn people and make all kinds of outrageous charges, and it's totally irresponsible. So I think there's this blend between blogging and news reporting now that's getting very getting merged, and there's some aspects of it that are very good. For instance, we did a story last week about, it's in this paper, about this major trip provider for Birthright, the guy who was responsible for the majority of kids signing up for Birthright. Who just left, ostensibly because he said that the Birthright people weren't letting him give his message of that, you know, Jews should marry Jews and have Jewish babies. And it looked like the Birthright people didn't want to get into it too much with him and talk about why they were critical of him. But in doing the story, the reporter put out on Twitter, Who's gone on the trip with this Oramim is the provider, and the guy's name is Momo. Everybody knows him as Momo. And if you know about him, he's like a world larger than life character. And so within 20 minutes, she had like 8 people with their names and phone numbers and said, I'm happy to talk to you. Some of them thought he was a great guy. Some of them thought he wasn't. But so in terms of resources, it's remarkable, but it's just sort of the next frontier. It's just it's the Wild West, the whole internet. There's like some wonderful things, some outrageous things, and there's nothing reining it in or helping people determine what's true and what isn't. You know, I mean, the idea of Wikipedia, which is fascinating to me, is that I guess it's sort of a microcosm of what they say about journalism. The journalism's the first draft of history, you know. If we get the story wrong today, we'll get it right tomorrow. It's a corrective. The newspaper is a corrective. So Wikipedia, I guess, makes the same argument that they, you know, you just keep at it till you get it right. Yeah.
You know, the director remarked, journalism has the germ of bringing into the shadows into the light. And I wonder whether that it's just information and relayed information is the end goal in and of itself. Because, you know, with the latter case, that seems to be, let's provide information to the public because maybe there's kids in danger and we want to bring justice. But often, especially with newspapers of economic incentive, there seems to be that fear of sensationalist articles on some level or one another, and that competing factor of just putting things into press just to sell.
So, I mean, that's always a criticism that, you know, people do things just to sell papers. I think it depends. Yeah, I mean, it's certainly true. If you go to the supermarket and you see the, you know, like the National Enquirer or the, even they've gotten more mainstream of late, but, you know, it used to be, you know, my kid is a two-headed alien, and people buy the paper. So I think the criteria should be credibility. I mean, that's the one thing in newspaper, once you lose your credibility, you're worthless. If people don't pick up your paper and think that what they're reading in those pages is accurate, whether it's some dramatic scandal or just saying that the Federation campaign raised $100 million, then you've lost it, you know. So, you know, most stories are, you know, informational, educational, entertaining. I mean, there's nothing wrong with, you know, having people enjoy what they read in the paper. I think part of the difficulty for Jewish newspapers, especially when you do critical stories, because we've been focusing on critical stories, but they're all kinds, a lot of people, when they read their Jewish paper, they want to feel good about what the Jewish community is doing. They want to feel good about Israel. I don't think they have the same expectations or criteria as when they pick up the Boston Globe or the New York Times. I don't pick up the New York Times. I want to feel good about, you know, the Obama administration or whatever it is. But I think there's an extra element to people who subscribe to a Jewish paper. They tend to be people in some way affiliated with the community, supportive of the community, and so it's that much sharper and more controversial when you sort of make them look in the mirror and see something in their community that they either don't want to know about or they find very disturbing. So my whole goal is when I leave here today, you should say, boy, he really has a tough job. I can just do that. Yes.
I'm going to go back for a second because my daughter was born in the 36th.
Oh.
This past year. That's how I.
Oh, okay.
So in that regard, did you start that feature in order to counterbalance the negative press?
I mean, no. in words, no. And we have we started something last year. This is the second year of 36 under 36 of people under the age of 36 who are doing creative, innovative, good things in the Jewish community. Part of it was to help increase our circulation among younger people. That's true. We plead guilty to that. But also because it's just, we saw so many people doing amazing things. It's just a lot of work, so we decided like next year maybe we'll do 5 under 5. It would be easier. No, but it's very interesting. I'm thinking about a call I had last Thursday. Sometimes the same story that you have in the paper, you'll get calls, even consecutive calls, with people, you know, intelligent people who have the exact opposite reaction to the story. You know, it could be about I don't know about you, Ron, and say I read it. And it's a news story, not a column or an editorial, saying, you know, you're too tough on the administration, you're too supportive of the administration, but I got the same story. So it is a little bit of a Rorschach test, but I've done this with, you know, with kids sometimes talking about journalism. If I gave you each, piece of paper and said, write down, one paragraph or one sentence, about what we talked about today, that everybody would have something different. So it's not a science, journalism, and there's nothing totally objective about it. You try and be fair, or whatever, maybe only Fox News sense is what's their slogan?
Fair and balanced,
right. But you can't really make the case for objective, because, not only would you all write something different, but, if you think about it, things happen in the world, and you have to, decide what's worthy of putting in the paper the next day. It's everything about it is subjective. What story do you put on the front page? What story do you say is not worth putting in the paper at all? Or you put it in the briefs on page 42? What the headline is, what the picture is, every element to it is incredibly subjective. And you just have to deal with it.
Within the Lazarus case, even the OU, Lester Swally, and the Big Dean have left in their space, and if so, do you think it's still worthwhile for the conventions in those 10 years down the line?
That's a good question. And that's another subjective. Did they learn from it? Yeah, they learned. I think they're sort of quantifiable things that were done. In increasing standards at NCSY, things like that, just the people they put into place. But if you remember, there was a commission that Richard Joel, who was then at Hillel, was the head of this commission. But there was a private report and a public report. The private report has never been made public, and I think there's. I haven't seen it, but I think there's, it indicates that there were a lot of things that went on that had still not been addressed internally, within the institution. Probably a lot of financial things. And, how we'll look back on it, I don't know. It depends if there's another Lanner case that comes up 5 years from now and everything comes out the same. I'd say we didn't learn much, but from what I see so far, I think that there's been a lot of improvement and a lot more awareness, even on the parental, within the families. People talk to their kids and warn their kids about what to look for in certain actions that was not discussed before. Yeah.
This is me just being curious about how you deal with this. Let's say that private report ends up on your desk, and it reveals some serious problems that it might be fixed. Are you able to worry about that?
What do you mean, are you able to?
Are you willing to?
I guess it depends how you got it and what it says. So, the Pentagon Papers were... private papers, the New York Times during the Vietnam War published these secret papers, and the case went to the Supreme Court because the Times just published it, and it was a very gutsy thing to do. I think the Washington Post published it also, and I'm pretty sure the court unanimously supported that, but the government took so they're secret, and you can't. So I'm not equating this with life and death in the war in Iraq and Vietnam, but I think that's a good example of. I wouldn't say I automatically just say this is private and close it and put it away, and I wouldn't say, oh my God, this is a great scoop. let's publish it. So I think it depends, you know, what it says. And part of it might not be just publishing it, but then sort of taking that information and then, you know, following it up.
Yeah.
Is it also responsible for a specific Jewish newspaper to have all the authority to do the same from a metaphysical perspective?
There's nothing wrong with it. I think it depends on the paper, it depends on what it's trying to do. We don't see ourselves as an Orthodox newspaper, we say we're a Jewish paper, and we're for the whole community. Sometimes I think it means that everybody can equally beat up on us. Because we haven't talked about what the Reform community or the conservative community or the secular community thinks of the Jewish week. We could do that next time. But suffice it to say that I think it's part of human nature. I think that each element of the community thinks that we favor the other elements. So we don't have a lawyer on staff, but we have a lawyer that we use. Most newspapers do. And again, although we don't have a postdoc that we go to as a formal thing, I have friends who are very learned, and I will often informally ask them about something that we're working on, but not as, it's not as formal a situation. And the truth is there aren't that many dramatic cases that come up. More often it's more mundane, but more regular is this Jewish organization thinks that the story we did about them didn't cast them in an ideal light. Again, I'll give you an example from Baltimore with a prominent guy in the Jewish community. When he died, the Baltimore Sun, kind of wasn't the Baltimore Sun, just was he had gone to jail. He'd done something wrong. He served like 5 years in jail, and like 7 or 8 years after that, he died. So I think the Baltimore Sun obituary, like the lead was, so-and-so, who was convicted of this and this, died. So our obituary mentioned mostly the good things, but somewhere in there, about three-quarters of the way down, we also mentioned that he'd been in jail. These are fascinating things for somebody to do, actual research about how things are. I just said it's not a science. How different publications will treat the same event. Trust me, the family called us, furious at us for mentioning it, that the guy had gone to jail. And it said, it's a fact. But it's a tough call. Yeah.
I have a question. We spoke a lot about how what the responsibility of the Jewish week to look at issues within the Jewish community and also how to digest things that are going outside of the Jewish community from a Jewish perspective. But do you think that you have a role to play in the reverse? What's your role, or do you have a role to play in a wider field of journalism, either to write something from a Jewish perspective or to write about a Jewish issue in a paper that isn't?
We've done some of that. I think part of it is that the other elements of the community look at the Jewish week and seem to see what's going on, what are issues in our community, and sometimes we'll pick up on it. I met an editor of a national Catholic newspaper on a trip to Israel a few years ago, and very nice guy, and a good paper, and to me, very pro-Arab on its Middle East policy. And I think, in fairness, I'm trying to remember, I wrote a couple of pieces for him. I don't know if I approached him. I think he asked me, actually, to write an op-ed piece, which he published. And we tried to do that with the Amsterdam News. It's a black paper in New York. it was more of a concept than it ever happened. So we were supposed to exchange articles. But I think those kind of, we've done it with a couple of Muslim writers also. We've published some of their stuff and we've written stuff in that. So it doesn't happen regularly, and probably, I think it's a good thing if people learn more about each other's culture, but it does happen sometimes. You know, yeah, I mean, I think if they had the story, they would have done it in a heartbeat. They wouldn't have called anybody up and said, I'm agonizing over whether this is a story or not. You know, it's, quote, a great story. You know, it's got all the elements. So we'd like to think that we handled it in a more sensitive way than the hypothetical. In the 70s, there was a big nursing home scandal in New York. There was an Orthodox rabbi who was alleged to have, after people died, didn't tell the families that they died, and he was collecting money from the families and keeping people in the freezer. Well, it was a horrible story. And it broke in the Village Voice, and I still have the cover, I saved it. It's a huge picture of this guy with a white beard and a big black velvet yarmulke, and the headline is, The Meanest Man in New York. And I was at the Jewish Week the first time then, as the kid who, you know, actually went out of the building, and I started calling prominent people in the community and said, oh, we've known about this for years, you know. But we've heard about this for years. I don't know that they knew all the details. So, you know, I was shocked. And so I'd like to think that stories that, if the same story had been done, let's say, in the Jewish Week, it would have not been as quite as sensationalist, but would have still had the information there. But, you know, but that's the goal. It's not to keep things hidden, but to... And you still get people who say, you should never do such a story, it's terrible. Yeah.
One of the points that is in terms of finding the reputation of people like that, one question journalists ask themselves, the more important question is not whether to publish an article or not, or a story, but in what way to do so, what's been put on it. And so I think that just beginning to look at some of the halakhic literature, many people seem to deal with some of these questions on what's the proper way of presenting a story, presenting information, not necessarily from the media perspective, but on an individual level. So I was wondering, I think it would be helpful, at least to me, when thinking, going back to the halakhic sources, what, like, if you could talk a little bit about the framework of which journalists think about the criteria by which, how to decide how to present a story. What considerations
do you
take into account?
So part of it, I mean, it's a good question. Part of it's like no Shulchan Aruch of the journalism, in that, honestly, just about every story has its own dynamic, and so I don't know that you approach it, you know, A, B, C. Here's some basic things you do that, you know, I mean, just get the facts. Find out the facts first. Because the first stage is determining whether there's a legitimate story, whatever the story is. You know, if you have people speaking to you on the record, there's a whole, you know, whole category of how people talk to you, whether, you know, people say it's on the background, it's off the record, it's on the record, you can use this, I can stop the tape recorder, I'm going to tape recorder. So, you know, it's all about credibility. If you have a story and you quote 10 people in the story and you name them all and they're making allegations, particularly if some of them are, you know, have weight in the community, that's different than a story that says, according to rumors, you know, so-and-so is a crook. So I don't think there's, you know, a hard, fast rule about what you do in what order. But I think it's sort of human nature, or it should be, first find out what the story is, and then weigh it. I mean, one of the things I use as a criteria I know it sounds kind of hokey. It's like, what if it was about somebody in my family? You know, how would I feel about it? I also feel it's important for journalists to be interviewed by somebody else because you can't appreciate how people feel being interviewed and, you know, talking to somebody, asking questions for a half hour and writing feverishly, and you don't know what they're going to do with it. You know, are they going to use one line? Are they going to get it right? So until you've had that feeling, I don't think you can appreciate what other people, it's a lot of trust to open yourself up like that and trust that the person's going to, you know, get the right quote, and it's going to be not only accurate, but it's going to sort of sum up what you've been trying to say. I don't know if that helps. Yeah.
As an editor of non-denominational Jews this year, when you do your job there, you're a dummy editor and you're across the time, you're not editor, or touring someone, would you keep into account whether they value the Holocaust of Lashon Hara and whether there was a critique of any guidance?
First of all, I probably won't pick the, I mean, somebody else would pick it. But, I mean, we hire a reporter that is not part of the formal process, you know, of what we're looking for. But I think, you know, as I was saying before, I think whether it's formally about saying, wait one second, very few people have this number. Whether that person is Oregon. I think, you know, you're looking for somebody who is experienced and in addition to having, like, the technical skills, you want somebody who is going to be able to deal with the complex, passionate, and sensitive, and lots of other adjectives, community. And so I think that's a greater part of the process. Who will at least have a sensitivity to all elements of the community. There are plenty of Orthodox people I know who would be the first person to call for a halakhic advisor on the story, but I would worry about how they would treat a story about, you know, intermarriage or, you know, some element of a reform or secular community. I would worry that they would be dismissive of. So I think it works both ways. You know, they're talking about trying to write for the whole community and be as inclusive as possible. I worry about our tendencies to be insular and exclusive of others who aren't like us. It's not just Orthodox, but so each group, I worry about how they deal with or dismiss the others. Yeah, you
raised
your hand up.
Has there ever been kids who've actually been pressured and have not written the story? I don't think I can tell if that or not.
You know, it's funny. I just wrote a piece for a journal that's not going to come out for a few months on the relationship between the Jewish Week, in particular the Jewish newspapers in general, and UJA Federation in New York, and federations in general, and which is a love-hate relationship. So look for it on your newsstand in December or something. But one of the things I mentioned is I worry about us self-censoring ourselves. You know, I don't want to portray me or the staff as being so sort of certain about our positions or so cavalier about, you know, that we know the truth, that we know what's best for everybody. I think there are certain stories we know that we're going to get tremendous amount of pressure on us if we do, and I worry that it weighs on us too much, you know.
because the truth is it can have a chilling effect if you're a journalist and you start worrying about how different people are going to read it. Part of it is, I think, important to think about how other people are going to read it, and part of it is, can have a bad impact on you. So I'll tell you one quick story. My second or third week at the Jewish Week, I came in the summer, and it was like before Tisha B'Av, and I just had decided I wanted to write a column every week. And honestly, I was a little intimidated. This is New York, you know, and I came from little Baltimore, a little hick town, which I thought was a big city. And I was kind of feeling my way because of, like, what I should write about and what tone. And so I wrote this kind of kind of motherhood and apple pie piece. It was about Tisha B'Av and about Sinat Chinam. And, you know, we should all learn from each other. And I think if I look back on it, I'd be like a little too, nice, or tired is probably the word. Anyway, I wrote the piece. The piece comes out. I get a call from a rabbi in Brooklyn who is livid, demanding to come and see me right away. He's furious at what I wrote. And I was just, usually when you write something and get in trouble with, you know you're sticking your neck out, but you decide, this, I didn't know what he was talking about. I said, you said that Orthodox, Conservative, Reform, Reconstructionist, and secular Jews can all learn from each other. How dare you put the other groups in the same sentence as the Orthodox, and they're the only true and halachic, So I came home, I told my wife, I learned a very important lesson today. No matter what I write, I'm going to get somebody very upset. So I might as well write, you know, what I think, I believe, and not worry too much, because that was made a lasting impression. It turns out this guy was kind of a marginal, a little bit kooky guy, but I remember that call very well. So, yeah.
I guess a couple sentences of
Sure.
Because I think some of the questions are wandering around and I'm just trying to put them in direction.
Sure.
It sounds to me lucid to you there.
I'm going
to
sit a couple minutes.
Sure. That you're presenting the call to the rabbi on the liner story.
To what?
The call to the rabbi on the liner story is not so much as you felt personally do that. And if it's not been Orthodox rabbi involved, how does that way? So you're going to inform rabbi.
It's hard to say because I was immersed in the Orthodox world and all the people I was talking to, but I would like to think I would because I think what made me call him is I thought this guy might go to jail for a long time, and I don't know, I just felt like I needed to talk it out or think more seriously about it before I just put it in paper. I had already gone through the lawyers, I think.
So you're saying there was sort of a threshold of seriousness?
I think so,
that's,
yeah.
That's when he felt, because, you know,
because
I'm interested in the general, like you seem to have a lot of confidence in journalistic ethics as such.
I do.
To the point that it's not clear that you think that any unique policy perspective would change the general principles are not together. Is that there for trial?
Well, I guess what I said before, I mean, I'd like to think that there wouldn't be, you know, this big divide between what I felt was an impulse to write a story that, however critical it was going to be, it was going to, like, do something important or, you know, bring somebody to justice or something like that, but that I couldn't do it because halakhically, I was compelled not to. So I wouldn't want to be in that position, so I find it hard to think of examples where that would happen. That's an honest, I don't know if it's helpful, but it's...
Yeah, it is helpful. You can have part of the impetus to the program in some ways, I feel there is no guidance, and I'm trying to figure exactly why, and then the question that I wish I asked you is, you know, would it be helpful at all? It's not like we have parallel conversations with doctors. That's part of my interest in the notion of whether, on the whole, professionals are looking for Holocaust to provide codes of ethics to the professions or in general, the way at least the non-Orthodox community functions right now, is that people are reasonably confident that if they went into a profession, that that profession's codes of ethics is compatible with Holocaust, and you know, that doesn't have much to contribute to their professional life.
So yeah, I mean, honestly, I would say that if part of it is very appealing, you know, if there was some kind of halakha code for it, and some of it would be worrisome because I feel like I'm bound by it, and that's it, you know. So if I'm really being honest and saying that there's a point where I, just a cutoff point, you know, so some of it's a comfort. Say, well, I followed rule A, B, and C, and so followed it. The problem is when you still feel you should be writing something or not writing something, and the halakha code says otherwise.
I think the great thing I have is that you write the schizophrenic down the way.
I have the button right here.
Yes.
Yeah.
Is that different than the way you make decisions in the rest of your life? Or is that the general approach that there are different things about a very useful about ritual, and when it comes to decisions that you're not a real world thinking,
so I don't know how much you want to go there, but I mean, it's a very thought-provoking question. You know, I hear you. So I don't know. I mean, I have, you know, personally, I find the whole issue of Das Torah is fascinating, and also I think. It's, you know, it sort of brings down to a practical level what some of what we're talking about. And so people, you know, even within that, they pick and choose what rabbi they're going to ask, even if they decide that, you know, what the rabbi says, that's going to be it for me. You do have some wiggle room in deciding who they want to approach, you know. So anything that's even there, it's not that hard bound because, you know, a lot depends, you know, depends who I go to ask. Somebody was just telling me about, you know, like laws of Abelus. Thank God it wasn't even my situation now, but, you know, everybody knows if you go to this rabbi, if you want to be able to go to the wedding, and if you, you know what I'm saying, so.
Do you feel that your vision of journalism is significantly affected by your Jewish education and your identity? Not just the Jewish community, right? Those are all communal sensitivity issues. But if you had gotten past the Shabbos issues in whatever way, and you were functioning as a New York Times reporter, if you think that your approach in general to Michael Jackson's story, say, is different because you're offering education and because you have something of the art and such fame, whereas that's not the real world. The real world is, you know,
the way that we could go to the place. Yeah, so I think it's hard to parse how much of your response to anything, you know, what you attribute it to directly. I grew up in my father's rabbi, shul rabbi, so if I grew up all my life, my grandparents, my grandfathers were rabbis. I went to yeshiva, I went to YU, so I'd like to think it has some impact, you know, not only about deciding whether to call a post-it on story, but, you know, in my whole outlook. But, so I just think it's hard to tell how much of your reaction is based on that, you know, sort of a worldview. I do think, you know, I approach things differently at the Jewish Week than I did at TV Guide as a sports editor. It didn't seem to create, you know, these kinds of grand issues or problems. It was like, you got to get to spell the name of the quarterback right. That's the main thing.
Do you think you could work, do you think that you could have, like, you know, basically you work with TV Guide as a sports editor. So a big part of that is reporting now that you're reporting on drug scandals with all these specific professional athletes and their criminal records.
Right.
And things like that. Do you think that there's, you know, that it would be impossible for us to actually work in this environment because the ethical codes clash, or you can
Yeah, so I think there are probably examples of publications where it would be very hard to, and most where it would be okay. And honestly, I'm just still reflecting on what you said. I think part of it is I'm the editor and the publisher in this case. In other examples, when you're a reporter or you're an editor even, but not the, you know, the top person at the on the masthead, I think you can rationalize and say, well, I made my case why we should do this story or we shouldn't do this story. And, you know, and your editor is the Das Torah or the Post-it or whatever, you know, and he says, well, this is what we're going to do. And I say, well, I try, but I don't feel like I don't have that wiggle room. You know, I have to make a lot of these decisions. Still have a board, but, so I think that's a practical difference.
Okay, well, I tried one other thing. I'll bring you back to the
studio. Okay.
One other thing. I was just fascinated by the notion that you haven't seen the Secret Matter recording. But I would imagine that as a New York Times editor, the first mandate in a situation like that would be get the report. Right? Then we can decide if we want to publish it or not.
Well, we tried.
Well, I'm lucky, you know, like, you know, I suspect when I was ever coming up there, I would have been extremely disappointed that they not had a copy of the report very rapidly. And so I'm wondering, you know, the report that was a big deal, and I'm wondering to what degree, I think the whole presentation didn't seem as much as an investigational dirt as one might have in a New York Times type environment. You know, these are the things we have to spread, you know, it's mostly, it's not reflecting. I don't know if it's accurate.
You mean the way the commission did the report, or the way we did
it? The way that you described your role in the community.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, it seems that people come with stories and choose them to investigate, as opposed to these are things that the community, you know, the community needs to know everything about, right, about the way the Fish and Act operates, and so let's send our reporters out and find out how to do that in the Fish and Act, and make sure that the Fish and Act is clean. So this to me, in the original presentation, it doesn't sound like you're terribly excited about not seeing the report, even though you're suspecting that the report contains all sorts of things that never publicly out.
I think they were really, I mean, I don't want to go into too much, but I think they were internal matters. Yeah. I mean, as far as, you know, the main piece of it about what Lanner did, what who knew and when they knew, and what was and wasn't done, I think that, you know, that all came out in the general report. And I don't mean to leave the impression that we sit back and only do stories that are hoisted upon us. You know, we do proactive reporting and initiate things. And sometimes, and as I said, a lot of times we'll look into either organizations or stories or, that don't pan out. That just a lot of rumors about things in the community. So I think it's, and again, I should be honest to say that investigative reporting in the Jewish world is almost unheard of. And part of it is practical, and part of it is beyond practical. The practical part is you need a highly qualified person or people to do this kind of work, and a lot of it is not at all glamorous. It's you know, it's going over court records and legal papers and a lot of research. It often takes a very long time, and you know, 80% of the time it doesn't pan out to be a story. So we had an investigative reporter, Larry Kohler Estes, for I don't know 10 years or so. And he's not at the paper anymore, but as far as I know, we're the only investigative reporter in the country in Jewish journalism. The other piece of why you don't see it is because, particularly in community papers, it's it's a very sensitive issue to take on the establishment and to go poking around. And a lot of people are, you know, very resistant to it. So that's what most papers don't even think about it. So I think there should be a lot more investigative reporting in the Jewish community.
Hey, nice.
Yeah.
I guess my question is more based on the aftermath. It's coming from the place of, it was very difficult for me to read the entire article. It was 15 pages on my computer, and I saw a lot of the patterns, a lot of the same language. Not to say that the writing wasn't good, but just saying that the proof was like overwhelming in that sense. And I guess I don't know if it's necessarily a fear, but my hesitation then is, at what point does the journalist have the responsibility to say it's enough? Or the exact opposite, right after this story comes out, and then 200 million more calls or 200 more calls come in, all just, you know, verifying the same thing, well, you know, justice was done. You went to prison and you can, you know, the proper channels were followed and there was some sort of result achieved. So at what point are we as society able to say, no, we can't talk about that one anymore. We served the purpose. This is what happened. But now it's time to leave that story and just learn the lesson from it, but not beat the...
Right. Don't beat a dead horse.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't
want to
use it.
Well, no. Okay. It's a fascinating point you bring up, and I should have mentioned it, you know, in the main talk. Everybody suddenly became a journalist. I got calls from, you know, prominent rabbi that I'm thinking of. The first story you did was very important. It was excellent. It was too long. It should have been 3 pages. He was like laying out the story for me. And that should have been it. I should have written one story and that's it. I mean, in general, I'm amazed at how critics of journalism, how little they know about just how journalism works. But in any event, I found that among a lot of prominent people in the Jewish community were saying, you should have done the one story, you should have done the, you know, they had, it should have been 2 stories, and basically it was overkill. That was really too much. Whereas in the real secular world of journalism, when you get a big story, you just keep at it until it's not a story anymore. And so that was a big criticism I got. It was fine. It was very important one after this scandal, but that should have been it. I mean, I did a piece maybe 3 or 4 weeks after that. Well, one was this girl came forward. I spent a lot of time with the girl who ultimately pressed charges against him and wrote like a personal story. And she was 17 or 18 at the time, which is important because of the legal stuff. She wanted to use her name in the story. She had never told her parents about what happened to her. It's a very sad story because she was turned off to Judaism as a result of all of this. And her parents read the story about, the first story about Lanner, and she saw it in their house, and when she read it, she ended up telling them that this happened to her. Anyway, the day before the story came out, the mother called me up and said, you can't use my daughter's name. She doesn't want her name in. And so I was torn because, I mean, once she said that, I wasn't going to use her name. But I knew that people would say, you know, we made it up, or it just didn't have the same authenticity. Everything about it was accurate except it didn't have her name. But I did another story about sort of the limits of Kirov, or what are the parameters of Kirov? You know, when you have a charismatic rabbi who has great impact on teenagers and there are no parents around. And I think there was one quote in there, there was one quote in there that somebody used the word cult, you know, in I don't know, 2,000-word story, I think it was mentioned. And the OU took out a full-page ad the next week attacking me, attacking us, calling them a cult. And I mean, the truth is, I don't know if I have a stomach for it, but it would be interesting to go back and look at all, you know, the whole series of stories. So I think that's where the Jewish community's sensitivity was, the reaction was very different than it would have been, you know, when Watergate broke. You know, the Washington Post had a story about Watergate every day for, 10 months or something. And I don't think anybody questioned it and said, what are they still writing about President Nixon being a liar for? So that's does that answer your question? So part of it.
Yeah. And it's helpful to know, I guess, what are the mechanisms in place and what are people's thoughts as they approach it, but
so I think it's really about how different people react in different ways,
Are there things that you've seen in other Jewish newspapers that you've reacted differently to and think that maybe they shouldn't have known that story?
Absolutely.
Can you give an example of the type of those things?
Not on the record.
Yeah,
exactly.
So
I think we're too wimpy.
You know, there have been cases where we've got too far?
Yeah. There have been. But generally, I'm saying that I don't think it's because it didn't warrant some kind of report, but that either the way it's written or something else about it, you know, made it too titillating or too susceptible to charges that you're just trying to sell newspapers. In other words, I think you mentioned that this story was long and had lots of people. I agonized about how many is enough, you know. And I think I mentioned that I interviewed like 40 or 50 people. There's probably maybe 20 that are quoted in there. So on the one hand, you're trying to establish your credibility and say this is a widespread problem with this person, that person, that. On the other hand, you can overdo it, and it's just, I don't know where that balance is. I don't think there's an ideal line. Yeah.
Something I'm not saying it's a victim of thought for any reaction, but that so you view the role of Jewish and Jewish publications as special, focusing on the Jewish community, so we move forward on not necessarily being, a Jewish publication doesn't, fit, I guess, the question of values, right? As reporting on the Jewish interest subject, right? What are the values that, are just your standard, American journalistic values, constrained by, legal rules about libel and, the fear of lawsuits? Or do you think you use it as a place for values? And again, I think kind of this, but kind of looks at the fear of another, constraint, how it becomes a fear of constraint, on your job, and then is there a rule against, then to talk about, the values and all that stuff, in terms of the way you go about it? There's more, more purpose, a moral, more focus that, can become a discussion that then guides a newspaper, or is there some way, is that just not the role of
the newspaper? Right. So, I think you're raising good questions. One thing to keep in mind, newspapers are not just news. So they have editorials, they have columns, they have opinion pieces. So I'm just thinking, this issue, I think, We got a letter. We got a complaint because we had two sort of pro-settlements pieces this week. One was a straight op-ed, and one was one of our editor's columns, so it was sort of a semi-op-ed. But in other words, not a hard news story, but kind of sympathetic to the settlement. And so I think we're talking about values. I don't know if, you know, political values are part of it, but I don't know, we write about people who you know, are critical. We have news stories about what the administration is saying about settlements, that Israel is saying to defend themselves, but then we feel on the topic we'll solicit op-eds that have both points of view. So in the same way, we started a monthly supplement called Text Context, which is, you know, sort of educational Jewish values about bigger themes, mysticism, what's community mean. So we'll have 7 or 8 or 9 essays about a topic. So that's, I think there's an educational component there should be in a Jewish newspaper that's not just about, you know, at sundown tonight, Jews all over the world will observe X holiday. But this gets into deeper issues. I mean, it's a great opportunity for people who might otherwise not, you know, go to adult education class or delve into Judaism beyond the news, to present it in a newspaper. So I think that's how I'm interpreting when talking about values. I think that's beyond just news.
Well, I guess I was talking more of in terms of, into the values of how you present information, right? Deeper values of how you approach information,
right.
not just the content you have in your paper.
Right. So, and then I guess it gets back to the other question about, or a couple of questions, whether a newspaper like the Jewish Week should have even a halakhic advisor. I'm just picturing, you know, the editor is a reform or secular Jew. I don't think that's going to happen. I think, you know, in a formal way, if you tried to institute something like that, I think it would, there'd be a backlash and backfire. I think what's a better way of doing it is just, you know, seeking people's advice out on sensitive issues, but not in a formal way, at least not to a community paper. I don't think the Jewish press, I don't know if we have a halakhic advisor, but if they did, I'd expect to talk to that person. Yeah, a lot of things. Yeah.
We keep coming back to the same point, that the reason that the Jewish Week couldn't have a halakhic advisor is because the paper, as such, is not an Orthodox paper, which is very understandable. It can't be constrained by the Hadith because it's not, you know, the paper, so to speak, is not an Orthodox paper, but it doesn't bar the possibility, which I think what some of you are asking, that you, as an Orthodox mm-hmm. person, when you're going into it, the values that you take to the table, you know, you've been sort of, you know, saying why you couldn't have these values. But I just asked you, when you walk into a story, if someone could point out to you and say there really is a halakhic constraint, you haven't explained how you personally, as an Orthodox person, would allow that or not allow that to affect what you would do in the story.
So I guess I want to hear an example of where that constraint would be that would not be there for a journalist or somebody trying to be an ethical person approaching the same problem. And if you have a specific example, so I'm not trying to weasel out of it, but I'm just saying I'm not aware of cases that I've had or not had where the result would be different.
I think that's part of the whole point of the summer is to find it out.
Stay tuned.
4 to 5 weeks.
Yeah. Don't ask the question. It's hard to know the answer, but we took on a side of being what that rabbi did in Baltimore. And there would be a huge array of cases.
Yeah.
Right, which would be that way.
Anything beyond the weather report.
That's right.
Yeah.
So I know that's true that that really answers the question. What I could claim in the summer is the logic of what you're saying is that anyhow, that kill story that journal is actually allowed is obviously incorrect. And you would go look for another rabbi because journal is correct. This had a long history for me. Because when I was in college, the editor commentator was editorial saying just that.
Just what?
That, when you're a journalist, you function like a journalistic ethic.
Mm-hmm.
That pretty much has to do with your focus. And at that point, because that's why I wrote a chapter about that, I don't remember, but the text is like different.
I
probably argued more on the line of what Jonathan said. I suspect over time,
I think if I was editor of Hamavasar, I would probably have the same opinion.
The interesting thing is Hamavasar, for example, we couldn't ask Shailah. Because if we asked the Shailah, that would mean that the person we asked the Shailah to would be on the same political view as we were.
So that's a political reason why.
So the political reason we couldn't have, right? We couldn't be right. In fact, we never could ask if anyone was binding on us because then we would have to pass it on. Part of our purpose was to enable students to take some of these that we couldn't actually.
That's very interesting. We should do a story about that.
Right.
We should do a story about that.
But I feel like the question. I think the way I come down at on this question that John was asking in a sense is that it seems to me that you're really very happy with journalistic ethics, and that's interesting because you're unhappy with a lot of papers. Right? So it's really you're happy with the journalistic ethics and you operate on it.
I think that there are journalistic standards that are very commendable. Whether everybody lives up to those standards is a different story. Okay. But in other words, I think if you look at their eyes, the Society of Professional Journalists, and they have Shulchan Aruch there about how to handle stories. I haven't memorized it, but I mean I'm pretty comfortable with that approach.
Well, that's an issue there. Tomorrow we're going to bring our jerk codes to. So tell me, for example, he doesn't think anybody has ever read that code. And that he's the one who will not listen. That's the director of the Center for Open Journalism.
Okay.
His estimation of the state of the ethics is less. He's all those conversations much less angry than yours.
Well, maybe because he's dealing with all those papers, so the reality of those papers. And, part of the problem is you have to know a lot of the inside story and the back story. When you see a story appear in the paper, you don't know what went into it, what was left out. I'm thinking of, not to get too far afield, there was a story in the New York Times, a big story during the campaign, about John McCain that implied that he had a mistress. Didn't come out and say so, but he was traveling with this woman, and it wasn't his wife. And remember the story? I mean, it got a lot of attention. There was something about that story that just wasn't right, and on a lot of levels. And but I don't know what went into it. In other words, I don't know what the reporter found out, what they reported to the editor, or all that. Sometimes I think you need to know the backstory too.
How does this book take original kids? Because I'm interested. I need a fact pattern for the final truth also.
Okay.
So I can certainly see a significant amount of black authorities. It would just look at you and say, let's say not a nice thing to say about somebody. It's going to hurt Rick, and it's going to harm the family, and maybe there's some people in our community, but the reason we don't want in the Jewish week specifically is that there's some people in our community who really, will ignore those categories and the rest of the paper, and they would much rather not have to deal with that. And what's the public interest? So it's, right, So, you know, there's not a lot of excuse. Whereas you might say, well, our vision of the paper is that we're the paper director in the journalistic community. And so from the perspective of being the paper director in the journalistic community, this is something that is making news about the Jewish community and the secular press, and we can't bear it authority as making news about the Jewish community in the popular press. And there we have a nice clash between the vision of the paper and a plausible ending.
Okay. So again, I'd say look at the practical outcome. I mean, we ended up not doing the story. Now, did we not do the story because, you know, I'm grounded in, Jewish background that pushed me away from it? You know, I don't know all these factors. I think it's more about journalistically, we had no real rationale to do that story at the time. We didn't, but it does come up all the time. If there's a big story out there and it involves something Jewish, do we have to jump on the bandwagon? Do we only do it if we can come up with a new kiddush that makes it interesting? Or, you know, so there's so many factors that are part of it that it's hard to parse out, you know, how that decision ultimately gets made. I think it's a combination of things. So, I mean, the two counter pieces that you pose, I think, are legitimate. But Hillel and Shammai didn't agree all the time either, so.
Well, yeah, then you can just, something else that doesn't, there's an advantage in a sense, that I think Hillel can be on the time. Although, again, you know, that in itself is a decision because many people would argue, well, it has been defined about other times.
In those terms are sort of those black and white, hard, fast terms, obviously, we're beyond the bounds of, but I think on some of, ironically, I think on some of the more controversial stories, the Chofetz Chaim would be okay with them, in that they're serving the communal good, right? I mean, if there's a butcher selling fake meat, are you allowed to tell people that not, you know, this guy sells fake meat? It's not a problem, right? Or is it a trick question?
No. I really like the purpose of trying to get. I think it might be useful at some point after I take more questions to take us through, like the birthright story that Jesse just published. But it's interesting when you really, like, when I read the story, I was wondering, so, there's a story, but why is it necessary to tell? Because it put in the people's negative comments about the personality of the provider. And that might be the kind of question I would be asking.
So we'll come back to that. Yeah.
The point you just made is, you know, the other side might agree with some of the more controversial stories. So that may be true, because often the more controversial stories are the ones that really have to get out. But the implication of that is that you're recognizing that, you know, the less controversial stories, which don't have the same need to get out, you know, you could plausibly see someone saying that it's forbidden to get out. So that was the implication of that statement.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like that type of question that, you know,
I don't think forbidden is a hard word, but, you know,
I mean,
problematic.
On the science would have said, right? I mean, by implication,
yeah,
that you were admitting to.
Yeah.
So, this is like the type of thing that we've been trying to, you know, that we've been asking, is that, you know, you come to that point where you've already admitted it's plausible to you that someone actually would forbid a story which is not that necessary for the community. It's not the controversial story which everyone needs to get out. It's that minor story which you put in the paper even though it's not so necessary. So at that point, how do you relate to the fact that you know that there is significant halakhic authorities and that would say that what you're doing is questionable, and you yourself would say that this is not the story that really must get out. How do you balance that?
So you're right. I mean, according to those standards, I can't think of any newspaper that would fit within those boundaries. I mean, the irony that we're talking about here is like the Chofetz Chaim was publishing a newspaper, it would only be, you know, these provocative
you know, investigative reports.
And the weather.
And the weather.
Not the weather.
Never forget the weather. No, it's your way. Yeah.
So a slightly different kind of question, just because, not on the ethical side, but just because I'm interested in the kinds of, what we're dealing with, the holistic questions of the ethics, is also the question of what kind of institutional framework is required to put out stories,
mm-hmm.
and maybe that might also be more or less problematic. So, I mean, what's the business model of the Jewish Week, of other Jewish newspapers? How?
I wish we had a better business model.
I mean, tell me, like, what's the?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, you're working the same way any other newspaper does. At least in our case, we're supported by advertising and circulation, mostly advertising.
Mm-hmm.
Our circulation is in the 70s, like 75,000.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's mostly advertising.
It's advertising.
I know that.
I mean, you can have the most independent, let's say the New York Times, for example, it used to be seen as, financially secure and independent, but take an example, the Wall Street Journal. I've been describing different pressures from the Jewish community, whether it's from the religious community or from organizations. But any newspaper is subject to pressure from advertisers. You know, you write an article critical of your biggest advertiser, and, you know, you're going to pay a price for it.
But so, a Jewish newspaper, especially with a niche audience, you know, you go after the kosher supervisors, all of a sudden all your kosher restaurants are advertising in your paper.
Right. Well, true. So, how much should you or do you let that affect, you know, how you do your business? A lot of newspapers, magazines try and have this church-state separation between business and editorial. But in the real world, you're very aware of those pressures.
So just one more question. Yeah. I mean, I think the halakhic question would go the other way, but just in terms of the canons of journalistic ethics that you're promoting, like how you know that you serve...
Journalists, just the ethics.
Right, so you know that you serve an important communal function. I mean, publishing articles, like when an article like this is very, very important. So at what point do you, like, make a trade-off? And how do you calculate these trade-offs? Maybe I'll publish a sensationalistic article. Maybe I'll publish a softball article that I know will, you know, garner me either increased circulation or increased praise.
I mean, maybe the people who operate that way, but
in order to serve that important function of also being able to print.
I think what you do on a realistic level is you're aware, as I said, of the different elements of the community. In New York, part of what makes it unique is it had, I'm from a small town that had one shul. It was an Orthodox shul, but, there were maybe four Shomer Shabbos families. What always struck me was that it was a very cohesive community. That's all you had, so people hung together. New York is the opposite. You know, each element of the community has a big enough critical mass that you don't have to have anything to do with anybody else. You know, so the Orthodox community is in its own system, and it's, you know, the same others. So I do think, from where I sit, not because of my own religious or not religious, whatever, but my own background, I do try and be aware of that we're trying to cover the whole community. And so it doesn't mean we'll do a softball story about something, but to say, you know, we need to cover more about what's going on in the conservative community. We got beat up for this story. Which is interesting. About a conservative position on conversion. There's sort of two elements. One saying we should aggressively push for conversion, and the other is to lay off intermarried couples and have a much more delicate position. So I do think we're, in terms of stories, we're trying to write about all the different elements of the community. And part of what's imbalanced about it is the Orthodox community is such a well-defined community. you know, when you talk about the conservative and the reformed community, it becomes more amorphous. They don't have their own, you know, physical boundaries, and they don't have their own, you know, emergency ambulances and on. So it's different. But I digress, I guess. You want to talk about birthday?
I think birthday is a good story, and you can talk about the conservative mission. But I think that was, you know, so why is it a French story? And there, and in that story, there's nothing negative about birthday as a whole, but there is room for people to.
If I can anticipate, in other words, one practice that is acceptable in our newspaper is having somebody criticize somebody else in the paper, and even anonymously at times. But go ahead.
Does it matter to the story whether or not people like him as a person? And, you know, it's like the part of the story is he's claiming that his message was censored, and they're claiming that they just haven't moved to a 15% maximum. And so if you were 70% before, you're going to have 55% fewer people, and whether or not he was good at it or not, and what, it doesn't seem to matter very much to the story. Or whether people like it or not.
Okay, so, that's as good an example as any. First of all, I mentioned before, it's totally arbitrary. I mean, this is a front page story. And it can even have factors like, is it a slow news week? And, you know, do we have a digital story on the front page and do we have a local story? So those, notwithstanding all those, to me, it was a front page story because this was the largest provider of Birthright. Birthright, you know, has, and he claims that he's brought, was it 50,000? More than 50,000 out of 200. That's more than 25% of everybody who's gone on Birthright has been personally greeted by this guy at the airport and hugged. So the fact that anything's happening with him or that he's pulling out, this is, to me, made it a legitimate story. Then you get into the other factors, of how you do the story, whether it's fair, whether it gives both sides of the story. So I can tell you that part of the practical problem is we had a statement that he sent out to as many as possible of the people who've gone on this trip. He sent out a 3-page letter. So we had the letter, which was not a secret. It was sent to, you know, one of our reporters who'd gone on one of his trips, along with, you know, tens of thousands of others. On the Birthright side, the officials of Birthright did not want to get into they didn't want to get into a thing with him publicly. They had their own reasons. So there was a certain imbalance in telling the story, because he was on the record and he was eminently quotable, and they weren't. So that was one of the factors. And it was only when everybody closed ranks, the spokespeople, I managed to get somebody in Israel who agreed to talk to me off the record. So I think in trying to tell the real story, that was part of it was his personality was a problem. It wasn't just the issue that he said, you know, everybody said Jewish babies, and some secular people were offended by that. I think it was, and I think that was communicated in the story. But it had, you know, it had criticism. I think a part of it was that it was about his whole personality. You know, I think he was a pain in the neck to them, but they didn't want to say that. He said something like that. He was always pushing the boundaries or pushing the parameters. And so we'll see what happens with him. I expect he'll be back soon. Have I thoroughly, despite the cold air, put everybody to sleep? Or?
Yeah.
or still a few. Okay.
Maybe we should end the informal, formal section.
I'm just going to look at my, I had a whole page of notes. I just want to see if there's something that I must tell you that the that hasn't come up. But I think we pretty much got it. Yeah, I'm not.
So, maybe you should go through informal and formal session. So that people can stretch their legs and water it out.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.